It was a catastrophe, pure and simple. Now, looking ahead, we ask, what will a second Trump presidency mean for America and the rest of the world?
At this point, we can project Donald Trump will be the 47th president of the United States.
Well, on Tuesday, we learned that Democrats actually don't know how to rig an election. Donald Trump swept all the swing states, won the popular vote, and Republicans took back control of the Senate.
This is a magnificent victory for the American people that will allow us to make America great again. Oh.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. Donald Trump will become the next president of the United States. Let that sink in, if indeed it hasn't already. Perhaps you're remembering the fire last time, the turmoils and travails of the last Trump presidency. This time, frankly, it looks set to be much worse. Today we try to put the pieces together, try and make sense of a decision of the American majority that millions globally find bewildering and terrifying in equal measure. We've got two guests on today's show to help us make sense of this period of turmoil and crisis. In the first half, we talk to Graham Campbell, a longtime activist with the SNP. Graham is currently in the United States, where he has been digesting the results with other progressives. In the second half, we talk to writer and analyst John Pfeffer about what Trump stands for, how he's likely to govern, and what it means for the rest of the world. John runs Foreign Policy in Focus, a platform based at the progressive think tank, the Institute for Policy Studies in the United States.
Hi, this is Seema. I joined Another Europe is Possible in 2018. For me, the most important thing about this space is building a transnational movement for a more democratic economy, anti-racist politics, and global solidarity beyond nationalism. So that's why I hope you join the Another Europe is Possible family too. Go to anotheureurope.org/join and sign up to get access to an extended version of this podcast.
Graham, going into election night and the mood of it, did you kind of feel hope slipping away, or had it already slipped a little bit?
Well, to explain really partly in answer to the first question, we went to Washington, D.C. with the expectation that if we were asked to support the campaign, we would be going to Pennsylvania. And in the end, we indeed did that. We met the National Democratic Women's Organization, which was around the corner from where we were staying. And they had a bus going at 7 o'clock in the morning on election day to a place called Cambria County, a town called Johnstown. And we went there, and that's an old steel rust belt, ex-steel town. And indeed, we were a group of about 40 people on our bus. We were one of five buses that went from Washington, D.C. to that town and to that county. And it's a place where the Democrats thought they could make a real difference in terms of getting the numbers out for Kamala, but also to win the Senate race locally and the locals, you know, the Pennsylvania State House as well. In the end, we did. I mean, we were going to a classic get out of the vote thing. So it's going to registered Democratic supporters, people who voted Democrat in all the past elections. And the vast majority of the ones we spoke to, and let's say most people didn't answer doors, but the ones you spoke to, they did say they were still voting Democrat, and some of them were very enthusiastic about Kamala. But it was noticeable. If you've been in the US before, and I was here last year in New York, the prices are staggeringly, astonishingly higher than they were even last year. And if you've been going through this for 4 years with your wages being static, it's pretty clear that across the country there was this wave. From what I'm hearing, it's about 80% of districts had this wave of about 6 or 7% towards Trump, because basically people were dissatisfied with the cost of living. And the cost of living is extreme. I mean, it's difficult for me, and I'm a tourist, but still, if I was trying to live on a wage less than $15 an hour, and it take you 2 hours work to earn enough to pay for your breakfast in a cafe, you can see why people are angry with the Democrats in office. And I think Kamala wasn't able to distance herself enough from Joe Biden's record in office. And people also remembered what they were, you know, that they had more money in their hands under Trump, even though he was a useless president, and, you know, he will be even more useless now, and he will turn on them. They made a big mistake. But the trouble is that they can only remember the economics and how it affected them. It doesn't matter to them that the economy as a whole was great if you can't afford to pay for your gas, can't pay for your food, can't pay for your school books. You know, that's what people have been facing in the run-up to this election. And I think that's why Kamala lost.
On inflation, you know, when you look at the explanations, there's a kind of headwinds explanation, which is inflation post-pandemic. And then there's the go woke, go broke explanation, which is that Kamala was too woke. But I mean, the inflation story, the price of eggs, everybody knew that already. Everybody's known that for a really long time. How has it bitten everybody on the arse, I guess, is my question.
Right. Okay. So I suppose over on our side of the pond, we didn't really understand the full impact of this. And you know, anybody who's been in poverty anywhere in the world, if you struggle to pay your bills, if you're having, when you're going around shopping, having a calculator, which I saw people doing, having a calculator, working out what they could afford, what they had to put back on the shelf. We saw people doing that. And this is in a country where people are used to prosperity, having a spare cash to do stuff. You know, this is a society that only 4 years ago, before that pandemic, was, you know, doing quite well. You know, working people could afford to work on a relatively low wage job, but still afford to pay for everything. Now they can't afford to pay for everything. And even if the economy is slightly shifting, the inflation rate is going down, the rich are doing quite well, people have got assets, they're doing very well. But people who haven't got that stuff, people who are living from paycheck to paycheck, have suffered. They really have suffered. And I remember what it was like having to be poor and also to, you know, worry about every cent that you're spending in a shop. If you've lived like that, the resentment that you feel over a period of years, that doesn't just go away because the economy slightly got better. Prices haven't gone down. They've just stopped rising. So I think we've all underestimated just how powerful that question of the economy has been. And Trump's message, when he's kept on message and criticized that, he's made headway. That's not the only reason he won. Obviously, in some places, so in Pennsylvania, there was obviously this general swing across the state. But also there was a question of turnout, enthusiasm in the big cities. Generally, the Democrats win these big states when the big cities turn out, you know, the Philadelphias, the Pittsburghs, and so on. This time, the turnout for Harris was less than Biden. There was a drop in turnout. That affected her ability to win the whole state. She didn't lose Pennsylvania by much. It was like 2%. But it was enough, that drop in support and the slight rise in support for Trump around Latinos, especially. There's quite a lot of Latinos in the county where I went to look at. That shift in Latin American support was quite interesting. It's pretty clear that's partly down to that the Latin American communities are very diverse. They're not all, many of them are, you know, Cuban or Venezuelan. People are very strongly conservative, as small c, and anti-leftist as well. The successful efforts of Trump to plant the Democrats as big, you know, radical communists, they pressed all the buttons. But the big button that seemed to work very well for more traditional conservative voters was the anti-trans agenda. They did lots of advertising and campaigning against, you know, hanging the pro-trans label on Kamala as a piñata. And that seemed to work really well in demonizing the Democrats amongst Latin American voters. It's one of the major reasons why there was a big shift towards Trump, despite everything he said about other Latin American communities. You also have to remember that community is not homogenous. So, you know, Puerto Ricans are different from Mexicans, different from, you know, Venezuelans and Cubans. You know, they're not all the same. But if you look at Dade County in Miami, that's usually a surefire Democrat county. That went Trump this time because of the Latino vote. So there's many reasons why Kamala lost this, but that's one of them. Michigan as well, you have to say, Michigan, that was lost only by 1%. The difference there was the Arab community and the failure of Kamala to take a stand on Palestine. And you can compare that to what happened in the Senate races and also the legislatures. The Democrats actually won the legislatures in the same places where they lost the presidential election to Trump.
Yeah, that data point is really interesting, isn't it? The success in places like Arizona in the Senate compared to the presidential elections. So very tiny numbers of people in proportional terms, in terms of the enormity of American politics and population, etc. But some, you know, cross-ticketing where you vote Trump for president and vote Democrat for Senate does seem to be a bit of a phenomena that's made a difference in this election.
lots of split voting, as they call it. And I think people were aware that that was a possibility. I mean, my Democratic friends on the bus, many of them, you know, a couple of them were young people who'd never campaigned ever before and who felt the urgent threat to their life, you know, particularly LGBT people on the bus for that reason. There were campaigners who campaigned for Clinton or, you know, Bill Clinton or Obama years and years ago, returning to the fold because they felt the emergency to do something to stop the democracy disappearing. So the people felt genuinely worried as we were campaigning. So there was certainly a stiff mood in amongst Democrat activists, but definitely a worry and a concern that they could lose. And that worry turned out to be correct. We already knew by the time you could see the turnouts from cities, big cities, was low enough to lose coming to the States. You already knew going to bed that you were going to wake up with a Trump victory. You know, the Kamala's watch party disappeared by 1 o'clock. They all went home from Howard University, and, you know, Trump's party only got going about that time. So you kind of knew what was coming. You know, there were some of those things that he couldn't have done about much about. I mean, you know, Biden could have stepped down earlier. Kamala, he could have made her the president. He could have stepped down as president. That might have made a difference. But in the end, every government that's done bad on the economy for most working class people, which is what happened here in America, they will lose the election, and that's happened everywhere across the world, and America's no different.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's a potency to the Trump economic message that is quite America specific in some ways, because I know you've emphasized the cost of living and that's part of it. But I think a lot of the Trump messaging is you were better off under me. Which, if you think that through, of course, isn't just referring to the poorest Americans. It's a message that's also appealing and indicating to his wealthy supporters too, i.e. you had paid lower taxes under me, you were wealthier under me. So that's like a part of this picture that I think it's quite American specific in the sense that, you know, the US has a near flat income distribution, right? There's enormous amounts of people at the bottom, and there's enormous amounts of people at the top. So it kind of inclines the Republican Party increasingly to build this kind of cross-class coalition, which is similar that we've seen around Brexit in England, I should say, with Graham on the show. I nearly said the UK there, sorry, Graham. But in England, you see that cross-class coalition of Toryism. But then just the other thing that I wanted to emphasize, and I don't think the left should lose sight of this, is that there is something deeply concerning about the craziness of the disinformation landscape. I mean, you mentioned Latino voters, Graham. You know, there was a Vox Pops in Miami. Yeah, it was the news agents, Lewis Goodall. And he was talking to Latino voters who were supporting Trump and campaigning for Trump and at a fundraising event. And honestly, it was jaw-dropping the narratives that they were believing in. So on the one hand, Kamala Harris is a communist and communism is bad, so we will support Trump. And when Lewis Goodall said to them, hang on a minute, Trump has previously referred to Mexican immigrants to the United States as rapists, they turned around to him and said, no, he didn't, you're lying.
He support us in the last government.
But okay. he won't describe Mexicans as rapists.
No, that is not true. That is not true. Is your point? I think different than you. Trump is the guy.
And so there is this kind of crazy far-right information system funded by people like Elon Musk that has agency that's affected this result in a very powerful way, I think.
I think there's no doubt about it. The post-truth era, the fact that what's perceived to be the elite's media is not having any impact and has a declining influence upon how voters think. And I suppose the disturbing thing is how many young people voted for Trump. And that indicates that there is a complete lack of historical awareness and understanding. And, you know, even Puerto Ricans, I mean, Puerto Rico had their election as well for governorship. And interestingly, the pro-independence candidate did very well. He came second. But pro-Republican candidate won the election, and they actually won over the whole island, despite what Trump had said about Puerto Ricans, and the comedian that made an awful racist joke about Puerto Ricans. Despite all of that, Puerto Ricans still had a swing to the right on the island. It's weird. And that can only be explained by recognizing that the Latino communities are not homogenous. They are affected by race, class, gender and identity, and are divided by those things. And the, you know, sizable proportion of Latinos are of African background, but that racism within the Latin community is a very strong, powerful tool which has been used. And also the sort of tendency of pulling up the ladder that some migrants have to, you know, pull up the ladder of opportunity to the newly arrived one. So, you know, we're citizens, you're not. So it makes us the good kind of migrants. You know, that kind of mentality was also very strongly in evidence. So that, you know, explains partly why Trump did so well, but also it was the lack of an inspiring message from the Democrats. I mean, the Democrats lost this partly because of they're having an inquiry about it. And of course, the centrist ones are all saying, oh yeah, we were too left wing and too woke and too all of that. It wasn't it. I mean, yes, that had an impact, but it was because they weren't saying anything concrete enough about working class people's lives. If they'd done that, they would have not lost ground amongst working class voters of all races and nationalities. The second thing was about the massive difference between men and women. And obviously that was talked about before, that women went very strongly for Harris, but white women didn't go as strongly for Harris as everybody expected. And black women in particular, who were 91% Harris in this election, feel somewhat betrayed by the way white women voted because of women's rights being on the ballot, you know, healthcare and access to those things being on the ballot. They feel betrayed almost by the fact that white women in such huge numbers voted for Trump, knowing what he stands for.
Can I just drill into the figures a bit? Because I've seen so much that's conflicting. Everybody's saying that young men broke for Trump. And this is because young women get their news off TikTok, whereas young men get their news off YouTube, and nobody in that generation is reading the legacy media. And so there's no kind of truth quotient. But I've also seen graphs that say actually the men who voted for Trump were Gen X, and they were much more likely to have voted. And this really isn't a story of young men, that the majority of young men voted Harris. What is the truth of this?
Yeah, so according to the CNN exit poll, a narrow majority, 49% of 18 to 29-year-old men voted for Trump. So pretty remarkable. And if you go to women, I mean, perhaps more remarkable still. I mean, among women, according to the CNN exit poll, 37% of young women 18 to 29 voted for Trump. It still seems astonishingly high to me. I mean, I know it's only a third of the electorate, and if that was across the whole of electorate, Trump would have been heavily defeated, but it's remarkably high, really. I mean, it's difficult, I think bewildering in some ways, for a lot of people all over the world to get their head around these numbers and this result, these kinds of results for Trump.
I think what it tells us that most commentators outside the country don't understand how Americans think.
Yes. I absolutely.
And having met quite a lot of them, including the pro-Trumpers, I mean, it was interesting listening to Trumpers following the anti-Trump demo as they were going along, saying, "You communists, you communists," and all that stuff. You know, "Open your eyes," one of them said to me. And, you know, he actually only had one eye, and he had an eye infection or something, so he had tape over one of his eyes, and he was telling me to open my eyes to what was going on with his Trump flag. So there was pretty clearly a psychology and a thought process that we're not understanding from the outside, which, you know, I can't really say I've got great insight into this, but it just seems that Americans live in a world of their own, which is very different. Most people don't have a passport, don't travel abroad, don't see what other countries do. So their world is their country, or their bit of the country. And I think they're not really influenced by global views about their country and how they're seen in the world. They don't really care about those things. I would be embarrassed if my country was led by somebody like Trump. But from their point of view, he's anti-establishment. He knows what he thinks. He stands up for what he thinks regardless. He doesn't go for this political correctness. And, you know, he's not part of the establishment. And for some reason, this billionaire, you know, huckster is seen as more relatable to than the people that the Democrats have put up. And until the Democrats put up somebody that's relatable, and Bernie Sanders has been saying the right things about this, the Democrats are in danger of learning the wrong lessons from it.
Well, thanks so much for talking to us, Graham. It's such a gloomy topic, but it's so great to get your insights. So awesome for us over here that you're in the US learning all of this stuff, and you can come back to us and talk about it.
John, welcome to the show. Solidarity, it's horrific. In your initial take on the election result, you say the Democrats could have won with a left populist campaign. Can you tell us what you mean by that? And how did Trump seize on and own the narrative on the economy?
Sure. So the left has had a kind of a populist message here on economics, basically channeling the anger of the American population, especially around inflation, but not just inflation, also the kind of gross economic inequalities in the United States, and the feeling that, you know, the billionaires and the millionaires are doing quite well in terms of economic progress, but vast chunks of the American electorate are not doing so well. And, you know, that was focused by Trump on inflation, and that proved to be a very profitable strategy by the Republicans. Where the Democrats did deploy a similar strategy, they were successful. There were a number of local races, for instance, where kind of populist Democrats like Marcy Kaptur in Ohio ran quite well ahead of the top of the ticket, namely Kamala Harris. And that should be a strong signal to the Democratic Party that this kind of messaging will be successful in the future. Trump, in your question, was basically how did Trump kind of own this economic messaging in the United States in this election? You know, he was able basically to tie Kamala Harris to the Biden administration, which is not difficult. She was vice president, so it was not easy for her to distinguish herself from the administration's record. But she could have said, when asked if she would do anything differently during her administration, she could have said, yes, I will. I will continue the very successful economic policies, for instance, the infrastructure bill or, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act, investments into kind of strategic priorities in the American economy. But I will, as, you know, president, pursue, you know, a much more vigorous campaign to raise the living standards of the middle class and the working class in the United States. I'll tax the billionaires, and I will bring down prices. She could have said, you know, this crazy idea that Donald Trump has of increasing tariffs around the world, that's going to increase prices for everybody. She could have hammered home that message, but she basically kind of ceded territory to Donald Trump to say whatever he wanted on the economy and go basically unchallenged.
I just have a little follow-up to that, because I remember her talking about having price caps, which sounded to me to be very radical, right? Mm-hmm. I haven't heard mainstream politicians talk about capping commercial prices in supermarkets, you know, in my lifetime, I don't think. But that didn't seem to land.
Yeah, well, the last time anybody really talked about price controls in the United States was probably Richard Nixon back in the 1970s. And it hasn't proven to be a particularly popular strategy. It's true that it was relatively radical, but I don't think it really translated into, you know, a populist message. In other words, you know, the American voters really were looking for very, very simple messaging on this. And, you know, the placards that you would see outside of people's houses and in public places that Donald Trump distributed were very simple. They said things like Donald Trump security, Kamala Harris crime. They said Donald Trump, you know, low prices, Kamala Harris high prices. I mean, it was very simple stuff. And price controls, that requires, you know, at least two sentences to explain what you're talking about. And I'm not sure the electorate was waiting already for two sentences.
So what I liked about your piece, John, that we'll put in the show notes, is that you exactly draw that distinction between what you might call a rational economic argument around policy and the kind of narrative that all politics is basically communication these days. And in the United States, that feels particularly true. I think it has sort of resonances with Europe as well. And you have this lovely vignette that you talk about in the piece that, okay, it's all anecdotal, but I've heard it more than once. Ezra Klein says something similar in his digest on the election, which is basically the phenomena of people who on the street who will tell you Kamala Harris is a communist, and then in the next breath say they quite like Bernie Sanders. And that just seems mind-blowing to any rational political actor, right? Sanders clearly to the left of Kamala Harris. So could you talk us through that a bit? Because in a way, that's what you're talking about, right? Populism is something that conveys a sense of identity and mission that's anti-elite and so on as a narrative. Because in many ways, you could look at the Biden administration, the outgoing Biden administration now, and say it was probably the most progressive American administration since the 1960s. It delivered things in terms of social welfare and support, the American Rescue Plan, that was almost a European style social security system, even though it couldn't get it through Congress to continue those policies. So in a way, I guess we're sort of trying to find rational reasoning type solutions here, but a lot of it, does it just come down to vibes?
Well, you know, as I said, the electorate wasn't really ready for a two-sentence explanation on things when they could get one sentence from Donald Trump. And the same holds true with the economic proposals and the economic achievements of the Biden administration. Many of those achievements were not immediate. They required, you know, a considerable amount of money kind of making its way through the American bureaucracy, especially the Inflation Reduction Act spending, for instance, for renewable energy, has to kind of filter through the states. It takes a while for this money to make its impact felt, and it's not necessarily so clearly tied to the administration. When I talk to people on the street, when I was canvassing during the election, what did people say? They said, I got a check that was signed by Donald Trump. I mean, this was immediate. It was, of course, nonsense, you know, because this was, you know, the check that was delivered as part of the, you know, COVID, the pandemic relief funds. And Donald Trump actually delayed that release of the check so he could put his name on it. But it proved to be a brilliant kind of marketing strategy because it linked actual payment to Donald Trump, the person. And so that when Donald Trump kind of makes these economic arguments, he's not making sophisticated ones about the rewards that will come down the line through policy. It's all about kind of a patronage system, if you will, that the person at the top of the ticket will give you money directly. Not all that different from, say, Elon Musk giving people money directly for signing, you know, a petition and entering you into a lottery, perhaps to get $1 million, which is what he offered, which was clearly illegal, but nevertheless was very kind of convincing for people in swing states. When we talk about, say, the distinction between Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris, you know, Bernie Sanders was actually quite successful in removing the socialist label from many of his proposals. He was able to kind of make them seem common sense, that they were just, you know, for the average American. This was not some kind of, you know, complicated European style socialism, though when pressed, of course, he would say that he did like the Swedish model. But it was just presented in a kind of American vernacular, if you will. So he succeeded in kind of removing any kind of ideological taint, if you will, from his proposals. And let's remember, these were just proposals. I mean, Bernie Sanders never, you know, made it into the White House, nor was he really able to translate any of his economic proposals into actual legislation for the most part. So he wasn't kind of forced to make those kind of important political compromises that would then, you know, would release funds at a certain point in the future. It was all kind of hypothetical when it came to Bernie Sanders, whereas Kamala Harris actually had her foot down on the ground with policy that could be evaluated, you know, through the administration's policies, of course, not through hers personally. But she failed to kind of distinguish herself from those policies when necessary, but she also failed to take credit for what happened. I mean, during the debate, for instance, Donald Trump said to her, you know, why didn't you do any of these things? You know, you have all these proposals, but you were in office for 4 years. How come you didn't do any of this? And she basically didn't answer that question, whereas she could have said, honey, we got the infrastructure bill through. You talked about it for 4 years during your administration. Mm. You got nothing through. We got it through. We did the work. But she didn't say that.
Interesting. You're clearly right. You have to wonder whether the Democrats were in the end a bit unlucky with the way in which the electoral cycle interacted with the kind of COVID economic cycle plus the war in Ukraine that dealt them a pretty difficult hand when it comes to inflation. But looking ahead, what should we expect from a Trump administration?
Number one is revenge. You know, he has been very clear that he's going to seek revenge for everyone who has slighted him or wronged him over the last 4 years. Top of the list, of course, is for him to make sure that all of the legal cases against him are dismissed or removed one way or another. He will kind of transform not only the Justice Department in order to do that, but he will have every kind of mechanism at his disposal to transform the judicial system as a whole. And he was quite successful during his first term in pushing through judges at all levels. And some of those judges, kind of not an obvious quid pro quo, but made rulings that were favorable to Trump. He will continue that. And it's even likely that he will have two additional Supreme Court justices to appoint. We have Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, the oldest members of the Supreme Court. My guess is the Republican Party will pressure them to step down and give Donald Trump an opportunity to name two more, which would come to five altogether, and therefore we would have a Trump majority on the Supreme Court. It's estimated until 2045. So that's number one. Number two, on the economy, we talked a little bit about tariffs. I think Trump is going to go after China in particular. He's, of course, said he'll apply 10% tariff across the board. And he has, to a certain extent, the authority to do that. You know, he can claim that that there's unfair trade practices and therefore these tariffs are a response to that. But he'll go specifically after China. He's promised as much as 60% tariffs against China. That will, of course, lead to significant price increases. In fact, it's quite the opposite of what he promised to the American consumers, which is a reduction in inflation. We'll probably see a sharp uptick in inflation. On foreign policy issues, such as kind of security issues, greater confrontation, obviously, with China. My guess is that despite his, you know, his boasting of a good relationship with Xi Jinping, given the attitudes in Congress, bipartisan, I should add, that we will see, you know, greater kind of containment of Chinese ambitions, more money spent in the Pentagon on that goal. Less money spent, obviously, on supporting Ukraine, though I don't know if a Trump administration will be quite as fundamentalist in terms of cutting off all assistance for Ukraine. We have the J.D. Vance plan for some form of peace negotiations to end that war, but there's still a strong push within the Republican Party to not only maintain support for Ukraine, but actually to strengthen it. So I think that will be a battle within the Republican Party. Lastly, I'll just mention immigration. That was number one on his list after revenge, I would say. He has promised, of course, famously, to deport all undocumented immigrants. That will be, of course, impossible, though he will probably be quite successful in deporting a lot of people. And we should remember that there was, you know, during the Obama administration, for instance, a huge number of undocumented who were deported. So there are plenty of mechanisms by which a president can do this, and he will have support of Congress. But there will be legal challenges, and there will be economic consequences. I mean, Trump himself knows, having he employed undocumented workers in many of his economic enterprises, so he knows how dependent the U.S. economy is on undocumented workers. So I think that economic realities will temper some of the more extreme proposals that Trump made during the campaign.
And just to return to Ukraine and bring in Gaza as well, both of those wars seem to come up a lot in commentary and vox pops ahead of the election. How did they feature in Trump's campaign? Did you get a sense of exactly how he would orientate towards both Putin and Netanyahu? And what should we expect in the aftermath?
Well, the campaign slogan was pretty simple. Don't spend the money there, spend the money here in the United States. There was no talk of, you know, anything more sophisticated than that. For instance, you know, what Russian ambitions are, you know, Ukrainian commitments to democracy or rule of law or international agreements governing sovereignty. None of that. None of that comes up. So it's all kind of pocketbook issues. You could argue with voters and say, look, the Trump administration increased Pentagon spending. Why do you expect there'll be any more money available for human needs, especially when he has said he's going to cut, you know, a lot of social spending anyway? Yet that kind of argument didn't really, it wasn't deployed sufficiently by the Democrats as a retort, and it was hard to kind of make that argument door to door in support of the Democrats. So when it came to Gaza, I mean, that was an interesting thing because, you know, again, there was a perception by voters that Trump could end wars. Not only that he could ensure that U.S. dollars would be going to domestic priorities, but that he could actually just physically end wars. And he could do so because, I don't think anybody would say this out front, but because he was a bully and he could use U.S. power to kind of strong arm Putin and Zelensky to come to an agreement and strong arm Netanyahu to come to some kind of an agreement as well. Now, that, of course, you know, was ignoring the fact that the U.S. has a limited amount of power, whoever is in the White House, to affect that kind of change. And it also ignores the fact that Trump himself probably doesn't have that kind of influence. I mean, Putin thinks he's basically an idiot. Netanyahu basically thinks he's a useful idiot. So it's not like Trump himself is going to be able to single-handedly end these wars. But nevertheless, that was a perception. What was particularly sad, of course, was a segment of the Democratic Party, or traditionally supporting the Democratic Party, such as Arab American voters in Michigan primarily, who made a decision that I don't think that proved decisive in that particular state, that swing state's vote count. But nevertheless, the Arab American community, at least a portion of it, deciding that the Biden administration and Kamala Harris were associated with genocidal policies, and that the Trump administration would not be somehow associated with similar genocidal policies. Again, here on messaging, the Harris campaign really failed to be convincing. I mean, I don't think either Jewish Americans or Arab Americans felt particularly confident that a Harris administration would be able to bring about a ceasefire, simply because the Biden administration, after endless, it seemed, agreements that it had kind of brokered, was still incapable of either strong-arming the Israelis or, you know, convincing the Israeli government that a ceasefire was necessary, first perhaps in Lebanon and second in Gaza. So this, again, was a kind of failure of the Democrats to provide clear messaging to the American population.
And what do you think about the big question of the future of American democracy? You know, so basically in the next 4 years, how much danger does Trump represent to the constitutional order in the United States. You hear some discussions apparently are taking place amongst the American military to undertake, you know, training sessions around the constitutionality of orders that they receive and the importance of not agreeing to unconstitutional orders. That's something that came up in certain moments in the first Trump administration. That just seems like a, in itself, a terrifying idea. But is the model here that we're likely to see something similar to kind of Viktor Orban in Hungary, a kind of oligarchization, kleptocracy, corruption at the center of power, handing enormous contracts to Elon Musk and others that support the Trump administration, but a kind of slow, or perhaps not so slow, corrosion of American democracy rather than it going completely kaput?
Well, definitely a continued erosion, and an erosion that, you know, I, to be honest, you know, pre-existed, was certainly happening before Trump took office in terms of, you know, the concentration of power among the wealthy and the wealthy's impact on politics and on elections. But, you know, the first Trump term, you know, was characterized by a mixture of incompetence and internal resistance. Internal resistance, even by Trump appointees, obviously by the civil service, but even by Trump appointees, the so-called guardrails that prevented Trump from kind of going completely off the rails. This administration, we will certainly see incompetence. I assure you that there will be high levels of that, if not more, because Trump is going to put loyalty above all, not competence, in terms of his appointees. So I think there will be lots of people kind of milling around, not knowing anything about, you know, how to enact policy. But we really won't have that kind of internal resistance. And we'll have internal resistance from the bureaucracy, though, of course, Trump will try to cut as much as possible and eliminate what he calls the deep state. But he also won't appoint people that will have any backbone whatsoever, will stand up to him. And that, I think, is the real concern. We'll see, as I mentioned, continued judicial quote-unquote reform. You know, when the Supreme Court makes a decision on immunity, for instance, I mean, for me, that's an erosion of democratic norms. And that, of course, took place before the election. That will continue. Some people think or hope or pray that the Supreme Court, in its wisdom, will provide some kind of a check on Trump's power, simply because you have at least some rational people on the Supreme Court. But given a number of its rulings during the Biden administration, I'm not so sure that that is likely to happen. In terms of whether Trump will kind of follow an Orban game plan, I think that's absolutely true, that the Hungarian example has been studied meticulously by the far right, and that they would like to kind of short circuit democracy as much as possible to ensure a, you know, a 20-year reign of power. That certainly was Steve Bannon's idea during the first Trump administration. But there are a couple of checks here. It's extraordinarily difficult to amend the Constitution. You need not only a supermajority within Congress, but you need a supermajority of states as well to sign on. So I don't think they're going to pursue what Orban did, which was basically rewrite the Constitution to get around any opposition, domestic opposition. But I do anticipate that the Trump administration will rely on its congressional majority to push through a lot of legislation that will be ugly in terms of democratic norms. For instance, ensuring that it's more difficult to vote, that there's more influence by money on the election, the same kind of strategy the Republicans were pursuing prior to the election, but they will want to make sure that they are not voted out of office 4 years from now.
So, Zoe, what did you make of the conversation?
Well, so I was really struck by how different the tone was to the tone post-2016. And I've been struck by this all the way through, a kind of grinding terror. There was a kind of outrage I remember the David Remnick piece just after Trump won in 2016 being kind of outraged and hurt. And this time I'm not getting much outrage and hurt. And there's a little bit of Democratic infighting, but there's much more kind of, okay, we're in a new world. And that, and you know, I mean, that's John Pfeffer's point, that, that this is post-politics. We can't deal in old money anymore. And I can really hear in everybody's tone a kind of scramble to work out what the new money is. Do you think that's true?
Yeah. I suppose, like all of the people in these kind of worlds that we're talking to, were in the end rooting for a Trump defeat. And I think it was reflected in the narrative up to the election day itself that in hope, in a lot of cases, rather than expectation, but I think people believe their own hope in those contexts, right? That the narrative actually was much more along the lines of Harris has run a good campaign. Abortion is going to be the deciding factor in the election. There's a wave of young women who will turn out and vote for Harris. Her numbers in this gender election will be greater than, you know, any gender divide that American politics has seen before. And yeah, sure, there was a bit of a gender divide, but it wasn't so different to 4 years ago. And so we kind of built up an expectation of Trump's defeat because we couldn't quite comprehend the horror of, you know, an American electorate doing it a second time. I mean, to do it the first time looks like a mistake. To do it the second time looks deeply and insanely idiotic and difficult to get one's head around, right?
I'd actually don't find it that difficult to get my head around, because I think it is about cruelty and kind of violence, really. I'm not saying the electorate, it's a bad electorate. I'm not doing that kind of really irritating commentary. You know, this is how totalitarianism is created. It's when people feel so kind of undermined and not cared about that very violent language really reflects back at them how they're feeling.
Yeah, I think so. But I suppose, like, Trump after January the 6th, I still think it's quite an extraordinary thing. So, you know, like, anyone in the Republican Party today is going to be crazy right-wing by most global standards, and certainly by European standards or Latin American standards. Pretty crazy. But Trump, after January 6th, I mean, his supporters actually tried to conduct a violent insurrection against the American Constitution. And for him to be able, in that few weeks following the January 6th crisis, to solidify his power and control, or at least create a pathway to solidifying his power and control over the Republican Party for a second time, does just seem quite incredible. I mean, I think a lot of the contingency of this, you know, the things that could have been done differently. I think when Kevin McCarthy went to Florida to visit Trump's palace shortly after the January 6th uprising and basically did a deal with him, very powerful person in Congress, McCarthy could in that moment have basically just expelled him from the Republican Party. He had the power to do that, but he said that this would destroy the Republican Party's electoral prospects in the future, because he knew that, of course, that Trump would stand against him. So, but that was a pivot moment. And I think that just does seem to me quite crazy and quite different from anything you've seen in the big authoritarian wave in Europe.
The difference from my point of view is that Trump is clearly in the service, even if he doesn't realize it, of kind of billionaire theocratic interests. And they see in him a very impulsive guy. He's hardly a completer finisher. He hasn't really got a kind of, he doesn't really have politics of his own. So if you're the Koch brothers and you want the Heritage 25 kind of vision for the future, or if you're Elon Musk and you want to shrink the state and bring pain to everybody in the service of long-term gain, then Trump is almost purpose-built for that. You know, he doesn't have his own agendas. He's very vain. He can be manipulated really easily. He's not going to kind of dig his heels in. And he doesn't have any principles. So, yeah, I mean, I think he's perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's two things going on, I suppose. There's one, a Republican establishment that is making concessions to Trumpism that it doesn't quite believe. And then there's another thing, which is what you're talking about, which is the more dangerous phenomenon, which is the radicalization of part of the American oligarchy towards white nationalist politics. And I mean, very, very powerful people with extraordinary amounts of money that are prepared to put that into hyper-conservative at best, white nationalist at worst, far-right politics. I mean, that's a scary thing.
Yeah, what scares me as well about the commentary, and this includes stuff I really, really like, is that a lot of it talks as if Trump tries to do some mass deportations and makes a hash of it. If he alienates a load of women, if, you know, there are kind of all these pathways to the kind of declining popularity. But I think he's kind of past that. I think in a way, every crisis will serve him. And that's, I guess, a kind of really 90s Naomi Klein kind of thing to say. But I think, you know, if he does make a mess, if there is a kind of spectacle of families being torn apart, of like real hardship and terror, that just serves his purpose.
Yeah, grim. So how do you think that the good ship, the Labour Party and the Labour government will respond to this? I mean, that wing of Blairism, Atlanticism, is sort of written into their intellectual DNA, the George W. Bush and Tony Blair bromance of the first decade of this century. And I have the feeling, I don't know if you agree, that there's a sense that in which Starmer wants to play that out, but realizes that it's not possible at the same time.
There's a certain kind of values rigidity to Starmer, which I really hope I'm right in thinking is there, which is, you know, I don't think he'd be able to smush it if there were open human rights abuses from the get-go. I don't think he would want to fall out of step with the kind of rest of the liberal order in Europe. I don't think he would prioritize the special relationship over really core principles.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, it does seem from the initial reactions that there's this attempt to love bomb the narcissistic authoritarian in the hope that he's not horrible to you and doesn't levy 20-25% tariffs on your goods. I mean, America's actually quite a big export market for the UK, even though we don't make that much stuff. But, you know, it's still 15% of our exports. Okay, just under half go to the European Union, and our European Union is much more important. So I suppose what a lot of people in the pro-EU world are now hoping is that basically this will be a pivot moment for the UK government, where they're actually going to have to be forced, or they've been forced, to decide between the US and Europe, and everything stacks up in the direction of Europe when you're forced to make that choice.
Well, that's what we'd like, right?
yeah. I mean, I suppose what the reason I caveat it is that Trump launching a trade war against Britain and Europe is still bad for those countries, right? So I'm just a bit reticent at presenting it as, whoopee, at least this is our big silver lining. Here we go. We're going back to Europe. I think it's going to be quite a lot harder than that.
Well, I tell you what I'm scared of as well, besides the tariffs. The EU was sort of the only organised bloc thinking seriously about tech and how it disrupted democracy and how it disrupted social cohesion and how it disrupted information and truth and facts and all the rest of it. It was the only kind of coordinated effort to think about how, you know, civil society catches up with this kind of entity which seems so much more powerful and all-seeing and has the potential to be so destructive. I'm worried that they're going to go head-to-head with Musk, and Musk is going to win. That's what I'm worried about. Because if he manages to suck the air out of, smother in the cradle, these kind of early iterations of states and international agencies reasserting themselves against what we know are incredibly destructive forces, then I'm going to be really worried about the next wave of elections.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, the data journalist on BBC Americast who was following social media through the course of the presidential campaign and actually has been doing the same job, I think, in the last election too, so has actually built up a lot of data. They created sort of artificial personalities that don't really exist and then monitored like what kind of content they were receiving on their social media feeds and from where and so on. It's quite an interesting exercise. And she thought basically that it can't really be underestimated that, you know, Twitter and Elon Musk takeover of Twitter might have had some kind of impact on this, because he's basically used it as a platform to promote Trumpist content extremely directly to everyone that uses Twitter. And the margins are so narrow. So, you know, even though Twitter's not an enormous platform, I think it did have like a couple of hundred million like users or something like that. You don't actually need to reach that many people in some of these states to have some kind of efficacy on the outcome.
No, and also there's so much more you can do with a platform that size than simply tell people to vote for Trump, right? You can make immigration seem like the most salient issue ever. You can make it look like everybody is talking about crime when they're not. You can completely suck the air out of what people are talking about. You can really distort what other people are saying, and we can't really overestimate how important that is as a kind of shorthand to political analysis. People who aren't that interested, they rely a lot on the sense of what other people are saying in order to kind of get their sense of what their fellow voters are thinking.
Yeah, totally. Any notes of optimism for us?
Well, no. I mean, I was going to say one, there's a kind of, it's not a mea culpa because obviously I'm irrelevant in this debacle, but I'm really surprised at myself how certain I was that abortion would be a decisive issue and how it really wasn't. You know, I think it was 14% of people said it was the most important thing. Mm. And that's not very high. And I'm astonished by that. But I just need to really have a word with myself about thinking that the things I think are important are what everybody thinks are important. What about you? Any optimism?
Gosh, optimism. Well, I suppose it's not really optimism, but it, like, related to what you said earlier about Trump feeding off chaos and crisis, I just wonder if his like people and institutional infrastructures around the far right are so much better prepared now to govern this time. One of the dangers that I see could be that they actually are quite good at governing, in quote marks, i.e. there's not as much chaos as there was previously. I was talking to John Pfeffer about earlier, you know, it's a possibility that actually these tariffs could be reasonably successful in perhaps rebalancing trade. Or, and this is, I guess, the important thing, they don't need to be successful for the rest of the world, but the US does have so much economic clout that will they be successful for the US? Seems to me to be a plausible avenue, and it's sort of hard to get your head around what a kind of progressive global response could look like to that kind of crisis and situation.
I mean, I wonder. Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing there is that, you know, at what point do you start saying this is a pariah state?
Yeah, well, this is like a lot of the global South are intellectually interested in de-dollarization, like getting out of using dollars in the global trade system as much as possible. But the problem is that it's very difficult to do that. And Trump has actually come in now and said, well, anyone that even talks about de-dollarization will have 100%, 200% tariff on their exports to the United States. So it's, yeah, it's tricky, actually. And, you know, China can't really de-dollarize because it sells so much to the US. So it's sort of inherently not a de-dollarizing economy.
But also, does it not still hold a lot of treasury bonds?
Oh, yeah. It's been gradually reducing them a bit from its highs. But because it does so much trade with the United States, you kind of inherently have to hold large reserves of dollars in order to manage that trade as much as possible to your advantage, particularly by keeping the price of your own currency pretty low. So it's like, it would be, I mean, trade justice campaigners are interested in this idea. Is there a possibility of a global alternative currency to US hegemony, which would be the democratic thing to do? But it's just not something that you can plot a very clear pathway towards, unfortunately. And in the particular role that the dollar plays is basically when there's a crisis, the Federal Reserve says that, well, all of the wealthy, important trading nations will now have access to emergency dollars through the Federal Reserve. And the European Union said it will never do that. I mean, it doesn't even do that for its own economies in a crisis. Look at poor Greece all those years ago. So it's sort of built on the idea that you don't do that. So where does this alternative currency come from? It's not really possible, you know.